Here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yose, your host. Thank you for joining us or sticking with us for our second hour on this Tuesday. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9. And don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yose. That is my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page. If you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me, I'll share it with the people, unless you don't want me to. And, of course, I won't do that. Coming up in this second hour, we will be joined by our friends from Baltimore Magazine, again, talking about their latest issue featuring the story Louder Than a Bomb, which focuses on the spoken word culture in Baltimore. I believe Lady Breon is going to be here, the poet, spoken word artist Lady Breon. I heard her a few months ago, I believe down at UB Blake, and she tore to join up. I mean, I'm looking forward to meeting her in person. Gabrielle LaSouza of Baltimore Magazine will join us as well. That's coming up a little bit later. But first, author Corey Johnson is in the studio. Corey Johnson, not Corey James. I think Corey James was a linebacker in the NFL or a fullback. Can't remember. But Corey Johnson is the author of the book Courageous and, just as important, Walbrook alumni. If he's a warrior, he's got to be all right. So, Corey, welcome to the show. Appreciate
thank
you,
thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right, and I apologize for flubbing. See that? Flubbing up your name. But you wrote this book, Courageous, a couple of years ago, and is loosely based on the life of your brother, Avon Flubber Johnson.
Correct.
A man who was, at the time, a notorious drug dealer in Baltimore City, but someone who the theme of redemption is a theme that I've always been interested in from the time as a young writer. Up until now, and this is, I would argue, or I'm asking the question, it seems like there's a story of redemption here, because he changed his life going forward before he passed and left this earth.
Yes, absolutely. That's the reason I wrote the story. I didn't want to just glorify him being a gangster in the streets. The reason I wrote the story is because that he changed his life around, and he dedicated the rest of his life on this earth to saving as many people as he could. He felt like he had hurt a lot of people and done a lot of damage, so he wanted to make up for that by helping as many people as he could get clean and get off the streets. So,
and we'll get to that part of the story, but let's go to the beginning. He's raised by a single mother, your mother?
Absolutely,
okay.
Yes.
By a single mother. Hardworking. I mean, these are the stories that we hear over and over again.
Right.
I mean, Baltimore's black community and communities, the backbone of those communities, have been hardworking, blue collar families for real, for many generations. And this is your family is one of those families. Let's describe your family a little bit, and then we'll talk more specifically about your brother.
Well, I thought that was important. The book starts out. Flubber's younger age, and he's much older than me, so I wasn't around during that time. But you have to imagine four young boys being raised by a single mother. She wasn't married at the time, so she's raising these boys. Our family come from down south, so you know, we had strong morals and principles, you know, Christian Baptist type upbringing. And I thought it was important to show that the people on the street know him as Flubber. The family knows him as Avon.
Right.
I wanted people to see the human side of him. Now, he's a human being. We all make mistakes.
Of course.
So I went to the beginning to show that he was brought up and raised just like any other young man in Baltimore. So I wanted to make that connection so that people can relate to him.
So as he's being raised in Baltimore by his moms in this family, what's life like? What are the years we were talking about here?
We're talking about the 60s, mm-hmm. As far as the younger ages. Mm-hmm. I guess the late 50s, mm-hmm. Early 60s. Mm-hmm. You know, so he was around during that time. Our family during that time, we're pretty much raised in West Baltimore, Southwest Baltimore. Right. So we went from pillar to post, you know, one house to another, but ultimately ended up in the projects.
But ultimately, I mean, when we're talking about the late 50s, early 60s in Baltimore, you're talking about a time in the city so much different than the time that we are in now, in the sense of, I mean, obviously there's a time gap, but I tell the story all the time that up until like the late 50s into the early 60s, families could sleep out in Druid Hill Park.
Right, right.
I mean, this was a different community.
Yes.
And then things changed, you know, with the what they called the riots in 1960s. Then the first war on drugs in the 1970s. And then when crack came in the 80s, then everything changed forever.
Right.
So, but it was a progression.
Right. And that's his era. You know, right. the early, what you mentioned, the drugs to the crack epidemic, you know, of course you and I were in
young guys.
Yeah, we were high school young guys, but that was his era. That was his heyday. That was probably when he was at the pinnacle, when he was doing his best, you know, he was the man.
Right. So, but before we even get to that point, talk about what the transition was like from that family life. You know, being a kid in this family, and your mother trying to hold things together to the best of her ability, and him finally making the transition and saying, I'm gonna try the street life.
Well, again, another point that I thought was important in the book was his relationship with my mother. It'll show in the book that her relationship with her father wasn't great. She ran the streets. She was rebellious. She was attracted to that street life, Pennsylvania Avenue. That was her era, you know, so that was the place to go to. And when she got older and she had these kids, she could relate to Avon wanting to run the streets because she had done that. So she kind of gave him a different perspective than what her father, who came from South Carolina, mm-hmm. his vision and his views were, his morals were different.
Right.
So she allowed him to have the freedom to run around in the streets. He was a smart cat, mm-hmm. so school was not, it just wasn't his thing. It didn't challenge him. He could take all the tests and do well and get good grades, but it wasn't interesting enough.
It was boring to him.
Right, it was boring. So mm-hmm. he was attracted to the streets. And although we have a large family, the street family, it was just different. They embraced him in a different way. They gave him something that he didn't really have because his father wasn't around.
Right. You know, it's an interesting thing. I'm just sitting here thinking, you know, many of my friends never got involved in the criminal element of the street, but all of us were attracted to that street as well. I would say this is my point, I guess. The lure of the street is unmistakable.
Right.
I mean, if you can sit here and act like there's no attraction, then, you know, I don't know where you come from, but you can't come from West Baltimore. If you are born in West Baltimore and that's where you lived and that's where you spent your time, the lure of the street is there for everybody.
Right.
Whether or not you delve into it or not and how fully you delve into it, that becomes the question. And that usually is the line of demarcation between situations that can be deemed innocent compared to situations that can become catastrophic.
Oh, no doubt. Obviously, everybody's talking about Jay-Z's new album. He's a little more mature and the subject matter is different. But he has a song on, I think, the Black album called The Allure.
Yeah.
And it talks about the allure of the game and how it keeps calling you back. And how, what you just said, how attractive that is. You know, even though you move on in your life, you become successful. And when you mature and you grow, you have to give up some of those things if you want to get away from that life. But he was saying the allure, you know, it's still some of those things that still are attractive, you know what I mean?
So. There's no doubt about it. And I think that we deny that at our own peril. I mean, we have to be clear of what it is and that way you can deal with it. So I just would make that was an awareness that just came to me as we were talking. When was Flubber's first introduction into the game? I mean, when did he first jump into it?
Well, from the book's perspective, and keep in mind, he wasn't here to give me this mouth to ear. I had to do a lot of research, and some of the people, like I said, he had four brothers. When he was coming up, that were right there with him. So I got firsthand information from other people that were there. And they said he started using at an early age.
Okay.
You know, he started selling and using at a pretty early age, like teenage years, mm-hmm. you know, which was, some may say, that was the thing to do, you know, during that time. It could have been recreational, you know, mm-hmm. we do it just for fun. But then that drug turns into an addiction, you know, and like you said, it's an allure, and it stuck with him for some years.
So when you say using, what was the drug of choice?
Initially, I think it was like marijuana, you know, things like that. And then it turns into, you know, the powder form, some cocaine, some heroin, things like that, pills, you know.
Right. Those, I mean, it happens. I mean, it's the recurring narrative, the gateway drug, people call it.
Exactly.
You know? And then and as you're immersed in that life, it turns into something different. And that was what we were talking about. Well, let's talk about, well, first of all, let me make the ID. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yoes, your host. I'm in the studio with Brother Corey Johnson. He is author of the book Courageous, a story loosely based on the life of Avon Flubber Johnson, a notorious figure in the drug game in the 1970s and 1980s in Baltimore, and also Walbrook Warrior. So, again, there have been several warriors who've done big things, man, in the city. I mean, in our age group, and I'm proud of that. You know what I mean? So I'm happy to have you in here.
Thank you.
Avon Flubber begins to emerge in the 1970s and 1980s, and he becomes the man, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that ascension, how that came to pass, and the trek that he took, and eventually when he made the turn and started doing things to try to repair, if you will, some of the damage that he had done.
Well, I try to be the type of writer who takes the reader on a journey where even though your eyes are open and you're reading the pages, it's almost like you're there. You know, you can close your eyes, and, you know, I mentioned some landmarks around the city so that people can, you know,
have a clear understanding.
Yeah, clear understanding, be right there. So as he gets older and he becomes the man, again, he's also a drug addict. So he hits what they call rock bottom at some point. You know, he loses everything. It's like a gamble. You know, he loses everything. And he's in a different place mentally now. You know, loses his wife, loses his money, cars, everything, you know. And he has to make a decision. You know, prison is an integral part of it because he's been in and out of prison for much of his younger years. And without giving the story away, he goes through something, I guess you could say, kind of catastrophic. You know, you would think that the addiction is enough to change you, but he goes through something else, you know what I mean? And that causes him to say, you know, again, we come from a Christian, you know, Baptist type of background, so he... You know, he got to turn to God because that's the way we were raised. He never forgot about that. And he made a decision, or I guess a pact with God, that if you keep me around, you know, I'll dedicate the rest of my life to saving as many people as I can. But he also wasn't, he was a fearless type of person. That's why I call him courageous, because nothing scared him. Mm-hmm. He wasn't that he was afraid to die. He just didn't want to die. So he was on his deathbed saying, if you can use my life as an example, you know, you don't have to do this. I've done it. And this is the end result. So use me as an example and look at my life. You don't have to do this because you can end up like me.
I'm going to talk about how he wound up doing that in a minute. But I think it's interesting to me, the parallels between Avon Flubber and a friend of mine, Israel Kason, who also abused drugs and sold drugs. And then through a spiritual revelation, turned his life around. And we know what Israel has done with I Can't, We Can.
I knew that's who you were talking about. Okay.
He had one of those, an eye-opening moment that changed him and had him turn away from addiction. He got clean, learned how to get clean, and then taught other people, and then has spent the rest of his life teaching other people how to get clean and how to live their lives in a productive way and to break the chain of addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the very interesting parallels.
I've heard his story. I know some people who came up through his program.
Yeah. A great man in the city. But so once Avon made that decision, talk about how he decided to reach out to people and try to repair some of the damage he had done.
Well, you just mentioned, I can't, we can. Back in Flubber's days, Axel was one of the prominent programs around the city. Mm-hmm. So he joined them, and he would have meetings around the city, dynamic speaker. You know, he's the type of guy, he walk in this room right now with you and I, you got to recognize him because he's just bold and charismatic. And because of his reputation in the streets, people knew that he was the guy that what they call shoot from the hip. He don't, you know, cut no corners. He give it to you raw. So when he would have a meeting and people knew that Flubber was hosting the meeting at St. James or St. Abraham's or wherever, they was going to come, and they came in large numbers. And he would get up there in front of the people in what they call the rooms and in those sessions, and he would be gut honest with you. And people knew that Flubber's telling the truth. He's not giving us no BS. He's telling the truth. So that caused people to want to follow his lead, because they was like, I've heard people say, if Flubber can do it, then I know I can do it.
And if I'm remembering our conversation earlier, that was one of the things that Hugh said, if I can do it, you can do it too.
Absolutely, yeah. And I felt like me writing a book was, if this story can save somebody's life, maybe somebody's going through not necessarily drug addiction, just anything, just being able to overcome whatever that obstacle or that thing is in your life that you find hard to difficult to come to overcome, you know, be courageous like Flubber and read the book and see how he did it, and maybe that'll give you some inspiration or some motivation to change your life.
And ultimately, the narcotic, the life, the use is what ultimately led to his demise, right?
No, I don't want to get a story away, okay. But no.
Okay.
No.
All right. Good. No, we'll keep it a mystery. We'll force people to buy the book. But this is not your first book.
No, actually, I have 4 books total. Courageous is the one I primarily promote because there's, like I said, a strong message behind it. And I hope to do some bigger things with Courageous, maybe a movie or a TV film project or something, play. But the other books are called PI Chronicles. I'm a Marine, joined the Marine Corps right upon graduation. I didn't go to college. I went straight to Marine Corps. And PI Chronicles is Philippines Islands. And it talks about a young black man coming from Baltimore, joined the Marine Corps, traveled around the world, and wound up in the Philippines. And you wake up one day and say, wow, you know, how did I get here?
That's the narrative that a lot of people have, brother. I mean, you know, you wound up in places and you're like, wow. You look back 10 years of past and you're like, wow, how did I get here? So that's a compelling narrative in and of itself. What do you think that Avon, what would his message be now, man, as we find ourselves in the middle of all this violence and all this addiction in Baltimore City, all this murder? I mean, he saw what he saw in the 70s and 1980s. And it's like almost history repeating itself if you think about the level of homicide that we experienced as a city in the 1980s connected to the crack implosion. What do you think his message would be to people today, man, if he was still around?
That's what I was about to say. You know, the era that we came up in, I know, you know, they calculate the numbers and the percentages with the population and versus, you know, how many homicides, and you look at different states or cities like Chicago and their numbers are greater. So it's a formula to that. But this isn't too far from what we went through in the 80s.
Right.
You know what I mean? And because Flubber was out there and he was actually probably contributing, he was a part of that particular part of Baltimore history with the drugs back then. I think he could give you a real life perspective and say, based on the things he's seen and what it ultimately did to his life, he would tell you it's not worth it. You know, he's one of those guys that could probably have a program in Baltimore right now with real life people who've lived that life that can go out here and talk to these young boys and say, listen, Jack, you know, come over here, let me holler at you. You know, he was that type of dude. Come here, man, let me holler at you. Take it to the side. It ain't about putting your business out there or embarrassing you in front of anybody, you know. But he will look you in your eye and as a man and have a real-life conversation with you. And I don't think you can take a whole group of people and say, hey, all of y'all come over here. Let's work on play on this side of the street, yeah. You know. But if you get one person at a time, you know, maybe we can make a change. You know, it's not going to happen overnight.
That's the important work, the one-on-one work.
Right.
When you can look a young cat in the eye and speak directly and authentically, that that does a whole lot more than having some dude on a stage trying to do whatever. I mean, it's just, that's just human nature, I think,
right,
to a great extent. It's interesting, man. Avon was not connected to, but he was operating during his time with some of the other more flamboyant characters in Baltimore drug culture.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Black and
Melvin,
Peanut King, and all those guys. So it's it was a perilous time, but a colorful time. And man, I'm proud of you, brother, for putting this book forward and doing. How long did it take to actually put it together?
It probably took me about 5 years total. I wanted the book to be real, so I have a few people who are close to me that were related to Flubber, some by blood, but some just close friends who lived that life. And as I would write the book, I would give them rough drafts and I would let them read it, because if it wasn't authentic, I wasn't going to put it out. So I had to get their approval, for one, to know that the stories were on point, but also that it was real. You know, when people read it, I don't come from that life. So I don't want people to think I'm an author who's trying to capitalize off of somebody else. I wanted the story to be real. So I went to people who actually lived that life to read it and say, you know, yeah, you got it. You on point.
Oh, excellent. How can people get the book?
It's available on all online book distributors, Amazon, Barnes & Nobles, iBooks. If you like electronic version, it's available electronically. And it's also available in paperback print version as well.
Okay. And the book is called Courageous, a story loosely based on the life of Avon Flubber Johnson by Brother Corey J. Johnson. Corey, thank you, man, for coming in and talking to us about this, and congratulations and all the best to you in the sale of your book. We appreciate you.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. It's an honor and pleasure to be here.
Thank you for signing my copy. I appreciate that, too.
No problem.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, our friends from Baltimore Magazine will be here talking about their latest issue featuring Louder Than a Bomb, which chronicles the spoken word culture in Baltimore. I believe Lady Brianna is going to be here, as well as Gabriella Souza. She's the arts and culture editor for Baltimore Magazine. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. Sean Yeo's your host as we wind down a Tuesday evening, making the transition from the drug world to the world of culture, the spoken word world of Baltimore. Our friends from Baltimore Magazine are back with the August issue features the feature article Louder Than a Bomb, which focuses on spoken word here in Baltimore. And in the studio with me is the arts and culture editor for Baltimore Magazine, Gabriella Souza. Is it Souza?
It is. Good job.
Thanks. It's good to see you.
Nice to see you too.
And I'm very happy to see also Lady Brianna, spoken word artist. Lady Brianna, good to meet you in person directly. Good to see you.
Absolutely. Good to see you, too.
I saw you tear it down at the UB Blake, I believe, a few months ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
I'd heard a lot of good things about you, and I saw it in person, so I was absolutely not disappointed at all. I will take the time, even before we start the interview, to invite you back to do some of your work on the air. We have some dope artist, spoken word artist on our show. I'm really proud of that. And I would love to have you back to do some stuff, you know, for an entire segment if you could.
Absolutely.
Right. I wanted to close the deal before we got started. But thank you all for coming through and joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Listeners of this show, I suspect, know this thing about me. This is one of my secrets. I was part owner of a coffee house back in the 1990s called The Last Cafe. And I was very much immersed in the spoken word culture in Baltimore City. I performed a little bit and had some of the greatest artists in the country come through and perform there. So it's something that I was connected to back in the 90s. But there has been an evolution, and it seems to be on the upswing. It seems to be spoken word is making a comeback, a very serious comeback in the last few years, something I'm very happy about. I'll ask you, Gabriella, first, since you were the one who penned this story. Mm-hmm. What did you discover once you delved into what was going on?
I mean, so much. Well, first off, you know, we have the youth and adult slam champion teams here from Baltimore, which is pretty incredible. So yes, you're right. You know, I feel this crescendo in the scene just in the last couple of years, especially as they head off to the championship in August in just a couple of weeks, the adult team does, and the youth team in July. I think what resonated the most with me while reporting this story was just the incredible amount of emotion and heart and courage that these poets have and how they really do represent Baltimore. And I think that that's the thing I really hope the most resonates with the reader, is just how much they represent the city and what they do and how profound the work is that they do.
Before you jumped into the story and before you immersed yourself into it, what were you expecting? I mean, what were you thinking?
You know, I'm a literary person. I write fiction myself. And so I was like, okay, I have an idea of what poetry is going to be like. And it's not.
A little different. Just a tad bit.
Just a little bit. Completely different. And it actually helped me in my own work channel a lot of emotions just watching poets like Lady Brienne and others do what they do, because they do it so amazingly.
I think what has to be said, and I say it all the time, and you know, people know me for my love of house music and the world famous Happy Hour, and I say all the time that we have to embrace our artists and lift them up to the level that they deserve to be lifted up to, because we have some of the greatest artists in the world in this city, quite frankly. And I maintain and believed it back in the 90s, and I believe it now, that we have some of the greatest spoken word artists in the world, in our city. And we have to acknowledge that, and we have to celebrate that. Because I can say, I've never met Lady Brienne, but I can guarantee you that her and her homies can go to just about any city in the United States and tear it down. Mm-hmm. I can guarantee it with every fiber of my being. I'll let you speak to that. Can you tear it down?
We can tear it down.
No, I mean, that's real talk. I mean, our artists in Baltimore have just historically have always been able to go anywhere and dominate scenes, and that's a testimony to that level of artistry and that commitment of the artists that are involved in the spoken word culture in Baltimore. How'd you get into it?
Well, for me, I started writing when I was 12 and performing around the same time. I had a lot of people who invested in me and my talent. And so it was cultivated at an early age. And then I was one of few youth performers, but folks like Olu Butterfly and Slankson Hughes did some events for young people. And I was able to start slamming and performing when I was young, as well as my art teacher, Ernest Shaw. As far as Do More Baltimore, which is the organization that is sponsoring the youth and adult slam team, as well as the Louder Than a Bomb Poetry Festival, I used to be a creative writing teacher, but it was overwhelming in Baltimore schools. And so I decided I wanted to venture out and just do some full-time artistry. And I sort of stumbled upon Do More Baltimore because they asked me to be a board member. They wanted someone who was an artist to actually be on their board. Right. Then once I learned about the organization, I'm like, no, I want to be a teaching artist. I want to help train young people. I want to become a better artist. And so I sort of delve into the organization and have never left. And so a lot of the success that I've gained as a team poet, like, is all because of Do More Baltimore. Mm-hmm.
Cool. So let's talk about Louder Than a Bomb itself, the competition, right? How did it come about?
How did it come about? I think you guys modeled it on
Chicago.
The
program started with young Chicago authors out of Chicago, of course. Now, their Louder Than the Bomb program is humongous. They service something like 10,000 kids.
Wow.
It's all across the city. You won't find young people in Chicago that don't know about Louder Than the Bomb. But it's sort of one of those sort of prepackaged programs that you can transplant in other cities. And so they can have sort of a reach across the nation. And so Baltimore was one of those cities that picked up the program and brought it here. And so for the last 3 or 4 years, we've been doing Louder Than the Bomb over at MICA. And basically, it's a competition that brings young people together to compete from middle schools to high schools. And we also include colleges as well. It's a 3-day festival. It also has a day of workshops, which we call Crossing the Streets. And the point is to get students from different sides of the city to sort of cross the street out of their neighborhood and mingle with other students.
Now, both of you young ladies are significantly younger than me. But do you know what the Louder Than the Bomb, where I believe, in my mind, where it originates from? Where do you all think it originates from? See?
You got me.
Tell us.
Youngins. Now, it's Louder Than a Bomb is a reference to a Public Enemy song.
Interesting.
Yeah. I will fact check.
I know
check
you
that.
You can
and
fact
I will
check.
Let you know.
You don't have to let me know. I know. No, it's a title of an old Public Enemy song. Louder Than a Bomb.
Doper.
Absolutely.
I know.
If that's
the case.
No,
it's
the case. You can fact check the journalists if you want to. Okay. You can do it. I'm cool with it because I'm right. It's an old PE song, I believe, off of It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, I believe.
Okay.
But yeah, it's easily fact checkable.
Well, it's an awesome title.
Yeah,
I think it is.
Talk about your team a little bit.
Yeah. So on the adult team,
you're on the adult team.
I'm on the adult team.
All right.
Yep.
Because you
whole
look
adult.
Right, you're okay. You look young enough. You look
I'm
young enough to be on the younger.
Thank you.
The teen team.
I will take that as a compliment.
All right.
So I'm on the adult team. This is my third year on the adult team. As a lot of people know, last year we became national champions when we won the
how
National
awesome
Poetry Slam
I mean,
in
how
Atlanta.
Awesome is
yeah. So this year we have the returning team defending our title. So it's myself, Lady Breon, also Slankson Hughes, Black Chakra, Kenneth Something, and Grim Jackson. The interesting thing about Grim Jackson is though he's on the adult team, he also was on the youth team last year. So he became the first person in history to win both the Brave New Voices, which is the International Young Adult Poetry Slam, and the Adult Poetry Slam in the same year. First person to ever do that in history because it's a very small window. Like, you have to be 19 to be able to qualify for both teams. So he was, you know, in that small window.
Do you know how excited it makes me to hear you talking about defending titles and world championships? I mean, this is what
I know. It's awesome to see Baltimore finally get recognition, right?
It's such an amazing thing to hear that our people are going around the country and around the world ultimately and representing the city in another way other than the way that is promulgated all too often. I'm pumped up. I'm ready to watch the championship match. When is the competition?
So the young people, so both of the competitions are this summer. Uh-huh. Our young people who are going to Brave New Voices to defend their title, it's actually next week on the 19th. They'll be going out to San Francisco. Then our competition is actually in August, starting on the 8th, ending on the 12th, and it's out in Denver, Colorado.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That is awesome. Gabriella, so when I know that you are the arts and culture editor for Baltimore Magazine,
mm-hmm.
and a literary person yourself, but I mean specifically, what drew you to want to write talk about this and write about this?
Well, I think the first thing I met Derek Ebert, who is the city's first youth poet laureate, when I first came to Baltimore 2 years ago. Okay. And he's an amazing person, and I was really struck by him. We had some great conversations. And then he kind of like clued me into the adult and youth slam teams. And then when they both won the national championship last year, I was like, we have to write about this now. And I think Brianna and I were talking before we came on, you know, the challenge with writing a piece like this is that spoken word in and of itself is such a visceral, auditory experience, right? And so writing about something like that is really, like, it's difficult to come up with. So it took me a little bit of time to figure out how to structure it. Mm-hmm. But what I try to do is follow a poet who actually made an appearance on the Adult Slam team, Mecca Verdell. She's a fabulous poet, young poet, and I kind of follow her through the process of competing in the Youth Poet Laureate competition this year, to hopefully like give you a sense of what it's like to write and get ready to perform and then to ultimately perform, because slam is such a special thing. So
you just said that when you first came to Baltimore 2 years ago. So where are you from?
Originally, I'm from St. Louis, but okay. I've kind of moved all over the place in the East Coast.
So talk about your experience of moving to Baltimore. I'm tying it to the spoken word culture, but ultimately, everybody who comes here has a certain perception of
right.
the city.
Well, and the interesting thing too is I came 3 weeks before Freddie Gray died. I virtually don't know a Baltimore very well, but without
Freddie Gray.
Yeah. So that was like life changing to be around that. I mean, my worldview is completely shaped by going through that experience with Baltimore. And I think it ultimately like made me very close and gave me this extra special tie because I started to question a lot of things about myself and the work that I was doing while the city was going through what it was going through.
Mm, amen to that. So, Breon, when you all travel and they know y'all are coming through, I mean, what is the response to the Baltimore teams?
Well, it's interesting because when we started our first competition after sort of a 15-year hiatus for Baltimore not going to national championships was that no one knew anything about us. No one knew what to expect. We were very unassuming. And then when we got to semis, everybody was like, okay, don't know where Baltimore came from, but okay, they're the city to look for. And then when we came the next year and just won the entire competition, then it was a very different conversation because we were still the underdogs then. Nope. It was still like nobody expected us to take final stage. We did a poem called Earthquake, which was talking about sort of, you know, the Freddie Gray moment, and everybody else was mentioning it in their poem, but we felt like we would be remiss as Baltimore City getting on final stage without talking about it. And it was, you know, one of those poems that everybody was talking about at the end of the competition. And so then it was like, okay, Baltimore is a lot different than what how a lot of other cities are, because we have this sort of gritty presence. We sort of write in a way that is very authentic and unapologetic and Black, right? And a lot of cities are they're sort of apologists in the way they go about it. They sort of, you know, they meander around the kind of topics that we directly approach, because coming from a predominantly Black city where we don't have to speak quietly about racial injustice, we don't have to speak quietly about our experiences, we get on stage with that same spirit. And people are just not used to that, right? When they aren't in cities where it's majority Black. And so people were sort of like, wow, that is refreshing and also inspiring and sort of baffling. Like, how dare they? But we did it, right? We did it and we won doing it. And we got a lot of backlash, I won't lie. There was a lot of people who felt like some of the topics were risky and had a lot of questions. But so now we are like the team that everybody talks about and everybody is looking for.
At the end of the day, when you take the gold belt and put it over your shoulder,
you guys have kind of opened the door for other teams to come forward and be a little bit more expressive when it comes to, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I know it's talking with some of your fellow teammates that they really express that they're seeing a change.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's fascinating to me that they wouldn't be. It's fascinating that there would be this hesitation, especially in the spoken word universe. I grew up listening to people like Tracy Morris and Jessica Caramore, mm-hmm. and my man, Amethyst Rockstar, Saul. Okay. I can't remember dude's last name, but it was in the movie Slam. I mean, these were audacious characters,
yeah.
and in your face characters, and coming from Baltimore, how can you not be an in your face character?
No, absolutely, we are, and I think that's what's different about us is, you know, coming from Baltimore, this is how we grew up, this is how we all think, this is how we all exist on an everyday basis. So our poetry is a reflection of that. But in other cities, it's just not the same approach to these kinds of topics.
Oh, I see why y'all won.
You
I
know,
they got broadside.
It was like a shock factor that other teams just didn't have. And I think that because it's a competition, poets are often trying to make sure that they can appeal to the judges, who are random people that are selected from the audience. So you never know who you're going
to
get.
Oh,
you never know who's going to be judging your poetry. So it is kind of a risk, not kind of, it is absolutely a risk to go and do your most gritty, unapologetic poetry, because maybe there will be a person in the audience who does not agree with
right.
anything you're saying.
Right.
You're running that risk, but Baltimore doesn't know how to do it any other way.
Oh, right,
so we go
that.
For what we know, and it worked well for us.
That's what I do every day on the air, go for what I know. So I get it, I understand. Are you prepared to do a piece today or no?
Sure.
All right, well, now, I'm going to hold it. I just wanted to make sure you are.
Okay.
I don't want to be anticlimactic, but I'm going to get to. I just want to make sure you were cool with that. What have you taken away from this, Gabriella? I mean, this experience. I mean, you have really been, and I didn't know that you only came here right around the time of Freddie Gray. But I mean, you have really been thrust into the cauldron, if you will.
Yeah.
In Baltimore City.
Mm-hmm.
So, what are these experiences, including the experience writing about Louder Than a Bomb? How's it changing you? How are you evolving?
Oh, that's a great question.
Yeah.
Well, first off, I think it's given me, reporting on stories like this gives me this incredible appreciation for just the incredible creative spirit that's in Baltimore. I mean, and it's the thing that it's amazing about it is that it's such a community. Like, people help each other so much. I mean, I watch the people, Lady Brianne and her teammates. I mean, they coach each other through everything. There's like very little ego, right?
And I wouldn't say that.
On the outside, maybe. But I mean, you guys really do help each other, even if there is
Absolutely.
There is ego. And I think that spirit just extends throughout Baltimore. So that's been incredible for me. And that spirit has nurtured me as a writer, and it's helped me kind of like figure out, it, just in terms of content for the magazine, what we should be focusing on. And then also myself, like what I would want to do and how I want my writing to be.
Indeed, indeed. What were in the last competition? Well, let me ask for a preview of sorts. I know mm-hmm. you're probably still thinking about what you're going to do in the next competition. But I mean, can you give us a general narrative, a general theme of like what you all are going to be exploring as you go forward? Because now you're in the hot seat because you're the defending champions
of two competitions
exactly.
now, because we just came back from winning a regional competition as well.
Oh, that's what's up.
Down in Louisville.
Okay,
so,
congratulations
yeah,
on that too. But I mean, now the pressure really is on, because y'all are now they're not going to be surprised because
not
now,
at all.
Right.
We have targets. We
right.
are walking
exactly,
targets.
Exactly. Exactly. So what? I mean, what can you tell us as far as what you're going to be looking to accomplish as you go forward?
So it's interesting because we can't do anything but be ourselves, and we're controversial by nature. So some of the poems were actually answering some of the backlash we got last year and
okay,
have
cool.
been getting. Throughout our sort of journey since final stage. And what I mean is some of the members of our team have experienced sort of backlash around addressing topics in the LGBTQ community. We've received some backlash about the way that we've even approached some racial issues and just our approach in general. And so a lot of us on the team are not just poets, though. Like, we're also activists and advocates in the community. So that's also a message that we're bringing to the stage, is we're not just poetry, and we don't do poetry just for poetry's sake, right? This is a way for us to express our everyday lives, because we do this work
it's
as well
life.
In the community, right?
Real
it's
life.
Real life. And so that is a part of our message, and that's one of my favorite pieces so far. I'm actually going to be featured in a piece that's talking about misogyny and patriarchy and sexism, and I'm so excited about it. Like, so excited. Yes, like, I'm so excited.
Face.
Simply because... a lot of people don't talk about it, but the poetry community is male-dominated, just like the rest of the world. So much so that they had to create a sort of another competition just for women. It's called Women of the World. And, you know, a lot of people don't talk about why that dynamic exists and why that had to be created, but you see it all the time at these national competitions. And I feel so empowered to be the one woman on the team, which is another thing you always see, and being able to tell my own story in a way that nobody's going to be ready for. And I'm so excited to like test it out. So there are a lot of things. We have some poems about some environmental issues that, you know, we're taking a stab at that is sort of outside of our realm, but is something that we're exploring as well. And then we talk about the Black experience, right? We talk about, you know, our hardships, our triumph, right? We talk about mental illness and there are so many topics that we sort of discussed. You know, you have to do 12 poems and you can't repeat until final stage. So there's a lot of space to sort of, you know, navigate different topics and dig deep on the things that we have personally experienced, things we've experienced with our community, right, and what we represent as a city. So there's a lot to be covered.
What is it like for you? You know, you talked about how the team was underestimated before y'all started beating people up and winning championships. Yeah. that y'all were underestimated. What is it like as a young Black woman from Baltimore? I mean, you're underestimated every day of your life. Talk about what it's like to transcend that. I know that's a personal question, but I mean, I can't help but ask.
But, you know, it's a part of the reason why I do what I do. I think too often, like you said, Black women are counted out.
Oh, a young Black woman from Baltimore City.
Absolutely. I mean, you know? Absolutely. Like, you know, there is sort of this idea that we never make it out of Baltimore, that we are not successful, that we don't have degrees. You know, I'm working on my second degree, but, you know, people would never guess it. And the reality is there are so many thriving young Black girls here in Baltimore that are movers and shakers and making change. And, you know, I love it when I walk into a room and people look at me and think I'm the baby in the room. I have nothing to say. And they underestimate my power. And then I do a poem and they're like, oh, mic drop. So, you know, like I said, it's a big reason why I do what I do. Like, I want to be inspiration for other young women to know, oh, I have permission to be as great as I want to be, right? I do the work of trying to mentor and raise up other young poets like Mecca Verdell, which she also had a feature on the team when we went to Southern Fried. She is one of my personal mentees, and I have personally been responsible for sort of molding her into the place that she is now as a professional artist. She's a radio personality. Like, you know, she's doing so much with herself, and, you know, I take responsibility for that.
I think Mecca's been on the show.
Probably.
I think she
probably. That's good. I'm glad to hear that.
Because she's everywhere and amazing, right? And a champion in her own right. And so, you know, for me, it is, like I said, a personal mission. And I think that we have to continue to do the work of, like, shining the light on our successful Black sisters. Because, like you said, we're counted out. And the truth is, there's so much amazing work happening. But we only like to focus on the negative. We only like to focus on the Black plight and, you know, I got pregnant at a young age and had to drop out of school, and the list goes on, right? But that's not what I see. I see Black excellence every day of the week, especially with the young people that I'm working with. And so, you know, I always like to shout them out.
Amen to that. So you ready to give us a radio-friendly version of something? You ready to drop something on it?
I was trying to think which one I could do. Yep. Okay. This, you want me to do it right now?
Yeah. Just
okay. So this poem is called Starbucks is Coming for Me. I'll just start. My neighborhood isn't safe anymore. Things are changing. There are intruders invading these borders. I see them setting up shop on every corner. Cafes trying to corner the market, slicing up bread and dishing dough, delivering the morning fix like we wouldn't notice. Well, I'm putting everybody on notice. Starbucks is coming for us. And then macchiatos make me sick. Baristas blow me. Coffee beans grinds my gears because I hear Starbucks is working for the man.
and lattes are a part of the redevelopment plan. Cinnamon in the air, daring me to swallow. White lines dividing tar-colored communities to they hollow yesterday. I smell cappuccinos in the air, so business suits are soon to follow. Men writing in loose leaves, drinking loose leaf tea, trying to erase me. No love for the cocoa. Lest it comes from a third world country where they got it for the low-low. Organic chai in place of impoverished eyes. The Wi-Fi is free. A small fee while they gentrify your community. Trading in your mugshots for mugshots. Cause who could be mad at pumpkin spice? The hood is at its boiling point and they just want to put you on ice. The type that will milk a mocha city white and sugarcoat the strife. Steam rolling the streets while steam milk foams on heat and espresso. Soon you'll be black surrounded by white domino or get delivered to a new postal zone like dominoes. They've come to cut off the competition and decaf the legs you standing on. The shorty in the logo looks like white supremacy. Whipped cream on a brown brew is their idea of diversity, which is to say, white will always come out on top and people of color forever at the bottom. Heated, tell me. Why are communities always dark, dismal, and depleted? Ayo, for real? Forget them cups of Joe and them $5 paninis with their tomato, mozzarella, and pesto. See, there is leverage and the beverages. So beware of the caffeine, because you see a Starbucks pop up and you know the developers are coming. Thank you.
Good God from Zion.
It's all so right. Weird, like, going
all
in the
snaps, studio. All the snaps, everywhere, all across the WEAA Nation, snaps for Lady Breon. Why did I need cappuccino? You know that? You hit with that? That's MC Light. All right. See, I got two assignments from me.
Okay.
MC Light and Louder Than the Bomb. That was incredible, yo. That was
incredible.
Thank you. Lady Breon, that's why we won the championship.
That's why we won the championship.
That's why we won the championship.
That's right.
Gabriella Souza, arts and cultural editor for Baltimore Magazine. Thank you for bringing this. When can people get the...
Yes. So the issue is being mailed to subscribers August 17th, but it's on newsstands next week.
And the great Lady Breon, sis, it's a pleasure.
Thank you.
You got to come back.
I will.
After y'all win the championship, come back and bless the mic for us.
Absolutely. And if I could say one thing.
Say anything.
If you liked what you heard, for those of you who are listening, we're still raising money to get our two teams to Colorado and San Francisco. So we have a GoFundMe. If you look up Baltimore Slam Teams, you can donate and the money will be split between both teams. I would really, really appreciate it. Baltimore Slam Teams on GoFundMe. Anything you have to give will be greatly appreciated. You can also look us up, Do More Baltimore. DEWMORE Baltimore, and I'm Lady Breon. You can find me anywhere, Lady Breon, Breon spelled BRION. Thanks, y'all.
Thank you both for joining us, and that is it for us. Unfortunately, First Edition is a production of WEAA. The show is produced by executive producer Sean Yose, associate producer Yorio Digizua. Our board operators are Andre Melton, Ty Rice. First Edition interns are Isaiah George, Wyman Jones, Kristen West, Alex Blanc, and Valentin Davis. Stay tuned for Wealthy Radio with Deborah Owens next, right here on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I am Sean Yose. Peace. We'll be right back.